109. Ector County negative 13,141 out of 16,880 tested, with 330 pending, 51 deaths. Recovered 2,452, active 906. Midland County 2,179 confirmed cases with 33 deaths. And from the Texas Standard, Texas reports over 7,000 people have died from coronavirus. 7,600 Texans have died as of August 3rd, 37 more deaths reported than the day before, 1,527 more than a week ago. 8,819 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 3rd. They occupy 16.9% of hospital beds, and that's 962 less than a week ago. 5,839 new cases were reported on August 3rd. There were 48,038 viral tests reported on August 2nd. That made the positivity rate 13.6%. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $41.37, which is up 36 cents. And now we'll bring you coronavirus briefs. From Marfa Public Radio, Presidio officials confirm county's first COVID-19 death. A 91-year-old man from the city of Presidio has died from the coronavirus while receiving treatment at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. Hospital officials announced the death Friday afternoon, saying the Big Bend resident died this morning due to complications with the coronavirus. This is the first coronavirus-related death of a Presidio County resident officially announced, which County Judge Cinderella Guevara confirmed, and the third person in the Big Bend to die as a result of the pandemic. Now from CNN and the Washington Post. As Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell left the floor this morning, he would not say what the plan will be on this week's stimulus bill. "We'll keep you all posted on any developments," McConnell said. McConnell has a shell bill on the floor that could be used to hold amendment votes. As CNN's Phil Mattingly reported this morning, the plan is to discuss with members at lunch today the path forward. Top negotiators on the next round of emergency economic relief cited a productive meeting Monday afternoon as they sought to build momentum toward an agreement. The somewhat positive tone sought to obscure a cold reality, according to people briefed on the talks. The two sides remain nowhere near a deal. Here's the latest on stimulus negotiations. The top Democratic and White House negotiators have now held six closed-door meetings for more than 10 total hours over the course of 8 days. By their own admission, the most recent meeting was deemed productive because the two sides had a better understanding of their disagreements. After six meetings, the two sides are still figuring out one another's disagreements. No amount of positive spin can cover up just how long and rocky the path toward a final agreement remains. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows will be back on Capitol Hill for meetings. Senate Republicans hold their closed-door conference lunch at 12:45 with a leadership news conference afterward. The area where there was at least some progress on Monday was on the education piece of the broader proposals. Republicans have put $105 billion on the table, split between K through 12 and colleges, with a chunk of the funds directed explicitly toward the cost associated with schools that are reopening. Democrats remain wary of tying anything to reopenings amid the pandemic and have pressed for more top-line money. But the negotiators did a deep dive into the numbers on Monday, which is a key step toward starting to lay the groundwork for what is actually needed for an agreement. As Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer put it, by going to these specific numbers and what each side thinks they can do with their dollar allocation, it really helps us understand that and move together in a better direction. That's what we spent time doing. Again, that seems like a fairly pro forma part of any negotiation, but getting to a more granular level has been something that has been missing from the talks up to this point. Kevin Hassett, a former senior advisor to President Trump and former chair of the White House's Council of Economic Advisors, said another lockdown order may be necessary in parts of the country. It does feel like there's some places that are too open, he said on CNN. The former administration member also admitted that there's a second wave going on, something current administration members have been reluctant to do. Major League Baseball is quickly becoming a cautionary tale, with players and staff on at least three teams testing positive since the season resumed last month. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred has even warned that the shortened season could be shut down if the league and players don't improve their management of the virus, ESPN reported. And several teams have already had to hit the pause button on previously scheduled games, including the Field of Dreams game in Dyersville, Iowa, which has been postponed until 2021. The recent cases and some players choosing to opt out of the season entirely are just the latest examples of how COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc in the world of professional sports. The issue teams are facing is not necessarily that transmission is happening on the field, but rather as the baseball players travel together, CNN sports contributor Bob Costas said. Teams that have opposed the Marlins and the Cardinals have not had positives among their players because of that exposure, Costas said. It seems like it's in groups. Teams that travel together, they're on the road together, or maybe breaking protocols to go out socially together. That's where the greatest risk of transmission seems to be. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that the world faces a generational catastrophe due to school closures, with more than a billion students out of school since mid-July. He urged countries to suppress the virus sufficiently to allow schools to reopen. As Congress continued to negotiate a new relief bill, Trump said that he would consider using his executive powers to stop evictions and lower payroll taxes if a deal is not reached. Arizona's superintendent said it was unlikely that schools could safely reopen by August 17th, setting up a potential conflict with Governor Doug Ducey. Mail problems marred the delivery of absentee ballots in Michigan, ramping up fears of political pressure on the U.S. Postal Service ahead of the November election. From the Texas Tribune, Texas sales tax collections went up in July and were higher than 1 year ago. For the first time in months, Texas's sales tax revenue increased when compared with the same period last year, despite the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, Comptroller Glenn Hagar said Monday. Texas collected $2.98 billion in sales tax revenue in July, 4.3% more than in July 2019. That revenue, which mainly reflects purchases made in June, was better than expected, despite the high unemployment due to the pandemic, Hagar said in a statement. The increase was due to a surge in collections from the retail trade sector, he said, noting that collections from e-commerce were up sharply as consumers shopped online. More online marketplace and remote retailers, Hagar said, were required to collect and remit Texas taxes on their sales thanks to a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing states to collect sales tax from online retailers that don't have a physical presence inside their boundaries, and two Texas laws that went into effect in October. Meanwhile, he said receipts from other major sectors in the state, such as construction, services, and restaurants, showed significant declines. Now let's move straight to our pre-recorded reports. We have quite a few of them to bring you today. The first reports are related to schools. This is from the Texas Standard. School administrators want flexibility when it comes to school reopening. Following that report, we have two stories from NPR. Without national strategy for school reopenings, parents face uncertainty. And the third report is coronavirus pandemic hits Catholic schools especially hard.
This has been no ordinary week. It's Friday, the last day of July. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. What a week it's been as Texans get ready to go back to school. It was Tuesday that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton issued a pandemic-related directive that said local public health authorities could not keep schools closed amid health concerns and prevent kids from attending classes in person. Then Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath said the AG's guidance, though not binding, meant schools would not necessarily receive full state funding unless given permission if they only offered virtual classes. Then on Thursday, the Texas Association of School Administrators issued a statement. Kevin Brown is with us now. He's the organization's executive director. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you.
In your group's letter to top state officials yesterday, you talked about how the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's letter on Tuesday, I'm actually going to quote this, muddied the waters and created more confusion. And what I wonder is the current confusion mostly in regards to funding?
Certainly funding is very core to our concerns right now. But the Attorney General's letter really put into question who is able to close a school.
Mm-hmm.
And we know by law that a school cannot ignore a county health order unless a court overrules that or the governor overrules that. And so this letter from the Attorney General does not change that. It definitely puts some pressure on county health officials, but it is not a binding letter.
Mm.
It's not even an Attorney General opinion. It's a guideline that was sent to one mayor and one community. And we know some schools are very frustrated that county health departments have closed them down. Others are appreciative of that. We just think it muddies the waters.
Well, I read the letter and it goes into so many places, including if the building is contaminated and only you can close it for as long as the building is contaminated, which is very different from the pandemic that we are going through right now. And I wonder if there's just this push and pull between state and local control. How do you see that?
Well, I think to some degree, you're right. There is a tension there. We understand completely the desire to have school in person to the degree that we can. And our educators are very anxious to have children back in school. But we also want to do it in a safe fashion, and that means we need to be able to reduce numbers of people so that we can socially distance, so we can take into account the CDC guidelines that are in place. In order to do that, though, we have to have some flexibility. So we have to be able to have children on some students on one day, some on other days potentially, or morning and afternoon. But the rules around that are so complex and confusing. And they have threatened to cut off funding to schools if they don't allow any child that wants to be in school at any time to be there. So we feel like local schools and their boards need to be able to make decisions based on the environment and the conditions in that community. But as you get into metropolitan areas, suburban areas, where the COVID outbreak is much larger, you start having concerns about bringing so many people together into a classroom or into a school building, because we need our teachers to feel safe when they come to school. And many of our teachers are vulnerable, and we just want to make sure that they have the confidence that they can go to work and be safe when they do that.
Have you heard back from any of our state leaders? Have you heard from the governor, perhaps, or Education Commissioner Mike Morath, or from Attorney General Ken Paxton? Have you heard from any of them as far as clarifying or answering to your letter?
Commissioner Morath, we speak with regularly. He, I think, has been working very hard. They've been able to stand up some very good resources for schools. We clearly haven't gotten everything we've wanted, but we do think that he has worked with us in good faith and is trying to make a difference. He does a call for all superintendents twice a week to have some dialogue there. And some of the shifting, you know, guidelines throughout the summer have been to some degree a response to the requests of schools. I think part of our concern, though, is right now we're still standing with, we don't have a guarantee of funding for schools for this coming
right.
school year. You know, we have hold harmless funding up to November, and that's 12 weeks. But our contracts with our employees, which make up about 90% of the operational budget in a school, we have contracts with all our employees, but we don't have the guarantee to fund those employees. And that's a very big cliff that we're staring at. Now, they've told us that they'll analyze the enrollment and let us know what's going on. And, you know, we'll wait till September, October to figure this out. But, you know, we need guarantees. We need our teachers and staff to know that they're going to have a job this year and that they're not going to be laid off in the midst of a pandemic. This is the time when we need all of our teachers, all on hands on deck, try to reduce our class sizes as much as we can and make sure that we're giving this generation of children the very best that we have during this big crisis that we're facing.
Kevin Brown is the executive director of the Texas Association of School Administrators. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
What are parents supposed to do as the start of school approaches? Many schools would typically reopen in August, but the pandemic leaves some still unsure what to do. Schools face the further complication of teachers who want to be sure they're safe. And for parents, the bottom line is, how can they keep their kids safe? And what can they just do with their kids? NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz is following this story. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
People are talking about teachers' strikes. What would that be about?
So yesterday, Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers gave a virtual keynote, and she said that they are authorizing strikes on the local level if schools don't get what they need to open in person safely. Hmm. Let's listen.
If the authorities don't protect the safety and health of those we represent and those we serve, as our executive council voted last week, nothing is off the table.
And so by safety and health, she means, Steve, following the union's own roadmap for reopening schools. For example, the AFT wants to see a positive test rate below 5% in a community. And right now, Steve, that would leave out 8 of the 10 largest school districts in the country.
Wow. Okay, so this is really interesting because there's not a national strategy for schools, obviously. There are guidelines that have been fought over and that the president has clouded. Different school districts are doing different things. But it sounds like there is a national strategy on the part of teachers. Does this mean that any district that opens up without meeting those guidelines is risking a strike?
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, local conditions and also local union leadership relationships are going to vary. But if the membership in a particular place is willing to do it, what this says is that the leadership has authorized it. And, you know, this is happening as, on the other hand, the Senate Republicans are right now bringing to the table a coronavirus relief package that is really leaning on schools to reopen in person. Out of $70 billion that has been proposed in aid to K-12 schools that they desperately need to reopen, two-thirds is currently earmarked to go only to schools that plan to open their doors in person for at least some classes this fall.
Wow. What does that mean for parents?
Well, you know, Steve, millions of us rely on public schools for approximately 30 hours a week of free childcare, aside from education and socialization and all the other benefits schools provide.
Yeah.
In 2019, you know, 3 out of 4 moms of school-age children were employed. 9 out of 10 dads were working as well.
Okay, and some of those people have lost their jobs, but as many as possible want to keep working or have to keep working. So what options do they have?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, some are out of work through no choice of their own. Some are choosing to step back to take care of their kids, and that has a lot of consequences, some are saying, especially for women's careers. Anecdotally, I've heard many are not relying on grandparents as much for care because of fears about the virus. And so I decided to take a look at what is really the next most affordable option out there besides family care. And those are in-home daycares where someone takes in a few children. And right now they take care of about 7 million children across the country. And, you know, these are small neighborhood businesses, some of which are licensed and some are so small that they're exempt. And interestingly, across the country, almost all of these providers are women and almost half are women of color. And experts who look at this stuff told me that in-home daycares are a model that could potentially scale up to meet this new demand for care for school-age children if we had the right support.
Scale up. So it already exists. The idea is to do a lot more of it. Are providers trying to do that?
Yes. I talked to Ani Garibian. She runs Busy Bee Childcare in Los Angeles.
The funnest thing is watching the little ones grow. Watching them develop and become people right in front of your eyes.
Garibian chose her home because she thought it would make for a good daycare.
I have a very large backyard. I call it our little park, where we have slides and swings and a bunch of little houses and play sets for the kids to enjoy. And most of the house, I would say about 80% of the house is dedicated to the daycare. I just have one small room that belongs to me and my kids.
Caribbean's business has struggled and even closed down for about a month and a half while the city was sheltering in place. But now she's back up and running, and she's even making space for school-age children who will need all-day care because the local public schools are starting the year remotely.
I was actually, right before you called, I was looking into desks and posters and all that stuff that I'm going to get to put together the classroom for the kids.
Those kids, right now a group of pre-K and kindergarten students, will be following their school's remote learning plans with Caribbean's help. They'll share meals and playtime with the younger kids, all at a cost of about $300 a week for up to 11 hours a day of care.
Home-based providers have disproportionately continued to serve essential workers during the pandemic, but they're also really struggling.
Natalie Renew directs Homegrown, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving the quality of in-home childcare. She says these providers operate on razor-thin margins at the best of times. Many live at the poverty line.
And also, uniquely, they work in the place that they live. So, you know, destabilizing their business also destabilizes their housing.
Advocacy groups are pushing for Congress to bail out childcare providers in the next coronavirus aid package. Republicans have proposed $15 billion, but Renew says they're going to need much more.
It's really sort of looking over the edge of a cliff. Many providers are already starting to close.
Health and safety is another key concern for in-home providers. Renew says there isn't a lot of good evidence yet on just how safe these settings might be, but there are hopes that,
given the small group size in home-based childcare, that the threat of transmission may be lower there.
Caribbean serves many children of essential workers. She says it's impossible to socially distance from infants or get toddlers to wear masks all day. She and her employees may be a little nervous, but she says,
people are desperate for income at the moment, so even if they do have some reservations, priorities take over.
Okay, so given all that on your comments, is this a hopeful story?
You know, on the one hand, Steve, I am so impressed that there are all these women out there who are really ready and willing to take up the challenge and provide quality learning and socialization to all the kids that need it. On the other hand, it's so troubling that they're being asked to work on such a shoestring, that they're fearing for their health, and that without subsidies, these daycares might have to close even as the need is growing.
NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
At least 100 Catholic schools, at least 100, will close permanently because of financial stress from the pandemic. As with so much in this emergency, the impact falls most heavily on low-income parents and families of color. Here's NPR's Tom Gelton.
Each month, more Catholic schools close. On July 6th, it was St. Cornelius in Richmond, California. Parents were caught unprepared.
For me, it's horrible because now I got to look for my daughter's school, my son's school.
Myrna Antolin's daughter was heading into seventh grade at St. Cornelius, her son into kindergarten. She could send them to another Catholic school, but they all cost more than she can afford on her salary as a nurse's assistant. So she'll probably put her son in a public school and focus on her daughter.
I'm trying to squeeze some numbers, and maybe I would have to do a little bit of overtime at work to be able to afford it. I don't want to put my daughter in public school because she's been in a Catholic school all her life.
This is a COVID story. Catholic schools that serve low-income communities are uniquely in trouble with the economic downturn. Parents lose their jobs and can no longer afford the tuition. Enrollment declines, and so does the school's revenue. Mary Pat Donahue directs the Secretariat for Catholic Education at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Usually 80% of a budget is made up in tuition. And then the remaining 20% is made up in things like fundraisers and donations. And all of those sectors have been negatively affected.
It's happening across the country. Thomas Carroll is the superintendent of Catholic schools in Boston, where 9 schools have closed so far.
If the school had a lot of low-income families in it, the schools got hit really hard financially. And the schools that were already on the edge, it just put them over.
The Catholic school enrollment problems go back years. Many middle-class families who used to send their children to Catholic schools in urban areas moved to the suburbs and switched to public schools. Enrollment in the urban Catholic schools declined. But for the lower-income families left behind, those schools remained important. In Richmond, California, plagued for years by a high crime rate, parents like Myrna Antolin viewed the local Catholic school as an attractive alternative.
St. Cornelius, to me, was a safe environment, educational for my kids. I'm at work, and I felt safe about leaving them there.
The pattern here, the parents who depend most on Catholic schools are the ones most likely to lose them.
A lot of the schools that have closed, they've been exactly those Catholic schools, the ones that serve some of our neediest students.
Kathleen Porter-McGee directs a network of urban Catholic schools in New York and Cleveland.
They don't just serve the students' academic needs. They're often serving the social-emotional needs. They're often providing a social safety net. They're helping support families.
This month brought the news that at least 20 Catholic schools in the New York Archdiocese are closing, six of them in the Bronx alone. And the story is not over.
We could be closing schools in September.
Tom Carroll, the Boston superintendent.
Because somebody could have put down a few $100 deposit thinking they had a job. And then all of a sudden, one of the spouses doesn't have a job anymore. And if you got two or three kids in Catholic schools, then you're like, we can't take the risk of spending the money. And so I think there's a second wave coming that's going to hit in the fall.
Carroll says the Catholic schools in Boston all got funding under the government's Paycheck Protection Program last spring, but that money will soon run out. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
Our next two reports are related to sports. This first one is tied to the school reopening issue. Texas allows high school sports in the fall. And then our second report, athletes are speaking out as NCAA considers college football season this fall.
As schools figure out their coronavirus plans for the fall semester, a big question is what happens with high school sports. States like California, Washington, and New Mexico have postponed many fall sports to the spring. But in Texas, where Friday nights in the fall are for football, public schools are going to give athletics a go. Michael Marks from member station KUT has more.
This is a big season for the Fulshear High School volleyball team. The Chargers won the school's first state championship last year, and they've got a lot of experienced players returning. But as coronavirus cases in Texas rose, then fell, then rose again, it became less and less clear whether they'd get a chance to defend their title.
You know, worried about my seniors not having their senior season, and to not have that would have just been devastating.
That's the team's head coach, Sydney Gocher. She breathed a sigh of relief last week, though, when the high school sports governing body known as the UIL announced its plan for the fall. Sports and activities like marching band got the go-ahead, with smaller schools starting on the normal date and bigger schools following a month later. Since bigger schools tend to be in areas with more coronavirus cases, the delay is supposed to help slow down the spread. Jamie Harrison is with the UIL.
Given all of the challenges, the variety of ways that COVID-19 is impacting different communities across Texas, this is the best solution we could develop based on what we know today.
Harrison said the UIL would only cancel fall sports as a last resort, but schools can choose to opt out. It's a decision athletic directors like Cheryl Fillmore are grappling with.
I guess the thing that I'm most concerned with is the fear that this disease, this terrible disease, could affect our community. And so with that, it's like, is it really safe to allow our kids to come back?
Fillmore is the AD at West Oso High School in Corpus Christi. The district schools will open on August 24th, and the first few weeks will mostly be online. But the school's volleyball and football teams can start practicing well before that.
Being that there's not face-to-face instruction, if they can't do that, is it really safe for them to come back to the athletic arena? We have a concern about that.
Schools are required to follow certain social distancing guidelines, but coaches realize that even if they play by the book, there's no guarantee that they'll get a whole season. There's at least an opportunity, though.
You know, I think if we're following the rules like we should, and we will as coaches, I think there's a reasonable chance we're going to be able to navigate our way through this.
That's Rodney Webb, president of the Texas High School Coaches Association and the head coach of the Denton-Geyer High School football team. As things currently stand, he doesn't see calling off or delaying the season.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, there's a football coach talking. He just wants to get his football fix in. Our kids need this diversion. Our schools need it. Our communities need it. It is woven into the fabric of our society. Those Friday nights are a microcosm of all that's good in our society.
The question that parents, principals, and superintendents across the country have to answer is whether the good that comes out of those Friday nights is worth the risk that comes with them. For NPR News, I'm Michael Marks in Austin, Texas.
College sports, like all sports, face an unsure future during the pandemic. And as the NCAA gets ready for the college football season, athletes from the biggest conferences are speaking out. In the Pac-12, hundreds of football players announced that they will boycott the season because of player safety, among other reasons. And in the Southeastern Conference, players voiced their concerns about playing during a pandemic to officials. And audio of that conversation was leaked to the Washington Post. Sports writer Robert Klemko was on that story for the Post, and he joins me now via Skype. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what was on the audio? What did you hear?
So the players' concerns mostly focused on how the medical officials plan to keep them safe. And one of the players, Momo Sanogo, an Ole Miss defensive player, said, you know, we can understand trying to isolate when it's just the football team on campus. But how do we isolate ourselves and stay healthy when there are students returning to campus? And the medical official's advice to Momo was to sit in the back of the class, don't engage with anybody, wear a mask, and when he could, encourage people on campus to also wear a mask. So not only are these players, you know, being asked by, you know, the most powerful conference in the country to go out there and you know, make money for the universities and be the biggest revenue driver for the athletic department in the school, but they're also supposed to teach their classmates to take COVID-19 seriously.
So what are we hearing from players with the Pac-12 players' demands? What are their concerns?
Many players in that conference have now threatened to opt out if a long list of demands aren't met. Some of them centered around social justice, some of them centered around health and safety, and some of them focusing on player compensation, which recently has become a big topic in the NCAA with several landmark court cases.
I mean, this does seem to be kind of like a power move by the NCAA football players. Is that fair to say?
I think so. You know, and I think a lot of them are just now beginning to realize their power. And a lot of that is due to social media. You know, while guys were sitting around and isolated during the pandemic, I think that conversation started between players at different schools, and it's, you know, grown into this movement, specifically in the Pac-12, that the entire country, the entire sports world has its eye on.
Yeah. How have players in the other major conferences responded?
I think the Pac-12 response has a lot to do with the demographics of that part of the country, where the majority of Pac-12 players are coming from more liberal areas across California. Certainly, there's a number of players in every conference that feel the same as the Pac-12 players and would like to do the same thing. But I think there's just a lot more opposition to that within their own roster, on their coaching staffs. So we've heard from Pac-12 players that players in other conferences have reached out. But I don't think anybody anticipates that another conference's players are going to make a similar move here anytime soon.
So the NCAA is the governing body here, but it does not seem to have an overarching plan at the moment for any of its sports. Do you see a fallout from this for the NCAA? Do you think we'll see changes?
You know, I think it's possible you do. It's not as if we're talking about an organization that often takes a back seat. And yet on this issue, they have. And they've let every conference govern for themselves what their pandemic response is going to be. And I think in the case of the Pac-12, especially where the Pac-12 is faced with either granting players permissions that would violate NCAA rules or not having a season, then the Pac-12 may opt to just have a season and deal with the consequences from the NCAA later.
Robert Klemko is sports writer with The Washington Post. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
The next report we're bringing you is: health experts urge a shutdown do-over as COVID-19 cases surge.
We are almost at another grim milestone here in the U.S., 150,000 dead in this pandemic. And now a group of doctors, scientists, teachers, and nurses have published an open letter. It's addressed to America. America's decision makers the message, shut it down, start over, do it right. Dr. Krutika Kupali signed on to the letter. She's an infectious disease physician, and she joins us from California. Dr. Kupali, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you all are calling for a nationwide shutdown again. Non-essential businesses closed, restaurants doing only takeout, leave your home just to get food, medicine, fresh air. What is your core argument here?
Our core argument is that, unfortunately, the first time we did this, we didn't do it right. So with cases soaring again in the United States, record numbers of deaths going back up, we really need to consider shutting things down again and using this time to get things right again so we can do a reset this time. So we need to get testing right. We need to get contact tracing up and going. We need to get isolation and quarantine going so we can get things right for our country.
Are you convinced that this has to happen everywhere? Because, I mean, communities are so different, and there are some that are doing much better than others and not showing a spike in infections.
Yeah, that is a great point. No, we don't need to do this everywhere. We need to do this in places where things are not looking good. So, for example, I'm here in California, and our percent positivity is about 7.5% for the last 14 days, and cases continue to go up. So in California, it would be a great idea to consider this. And in other places like Texas and Arizona and Florida and other parts of the South where we are seeing cases go up and deaths go up and hospitals at capacity and healthcare systems at capacity, we need to consider doing this because we know that this is going to continue to increase, and we need to try and preserve our healthcare systems rather than continue to put pressure on them so things don't continue to get worse. We need to try and break these chains of transmission.
Hmm. Who will even regulate that, though? I mean, if you're talking about setting some kind of threshold to say that if you reach this mark statistically, you have to shut down. I mean, I presume someone at the federal level would have to tell different communities if and when they have to do this. And isn't that part of the problem that we have seen? You have governors, you have local leaders, and it's really been on them to make these decisions. So how would you change that?
Yeah, so ideally this would be coming from some sort of federal universal plan. We have not had that. So we need to put this at this point on the decision making of our local and state governments. The states are going to have to make these decisions to do these things. They need to do these to look out for the well-being of their public and try to get things reset for their own societies, because we're not getting that leadership and that guidance from the national government. We are imploring in our letter to please ask the U.S. government to make these bold decisions that we need to make, to please step up and make them. We need to do this because the well-being of our public depends on it.
Isn't there, beyond convincing leaders, isn't there an issue of mentality? I mean, just the issue of face masks, for example. Aren't people so entrenched already when it comes to their views on that it might be really tough to change their minds?
Yeah, we do need to try and work on education and engagement and communication when it comes to these types of things. I think that we do need to work really hard and changing the narrative when it comes to these things. We know non-pharmaceutical interventions work. So things like physical distancing and wearing face masks, those things are very important. And so people trying to get people to understand that if we take these things up, it'll be very important.
Dr. Kupali, thanks so much.
Thanks.
This will be one of our last segments today. It's a 14-minute segment. It provides experts who are answering questions from people who are asking about everyday things related to the coronavirus.
You're listening to Shortwave from NPR. So, yeah, The pandemic has been going on for months and months, and every day scientists are learning new things about the coronavirus, which is why I'm here to tell you that you should feel no shame if you still have a lot of questions about it. Questions like, what's the latest on wiping down groceries? And how often should you disinfect your phone? And very importantly, can you say hi to other people's doggos? Today on the show, we have answers as part of a special segment I did on another NPR podcast called It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. And if you don't know Sam already, you're gonna love him, but not as much as he loves kissing other people's dogs. So stick around. I'm Maddie Sofia, and you're listening to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
All right, let's get to the questions. We got so many from our listeners.
Yeah, I know it.
We picked a few and showed them to you, so we're going to have you answer them right now, and I'll provide color commentary throughout. You're welcome.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
All right, first question, what's the deal with running? I've heard conflicting things. What's the likelihood of it being spread if someone runs past me?
Okay, so this question makes total sense to me because I think there were some scary kind of initial studies around this.
I remember
this that
there
been,
was one where it said like runners could spread it for 20 feet and they were these vectors.
Yeah,
but that was
yeah.
kind of mildly debunked.
Yeah, it was kind of dismissed. I mean, there were parts of it that made sense, but it wasn't considered to be like actually a real world scenario that was tested. And it's really hard to test that. So, you know, when I think about running, of course, it depends on what space you're in, right? So outside in fresh air, you're going to have a lower risk. If you're wearing a mask, if that person's wearing a mask, all of those things kind of factor in. And as best we can tell, Sam, as a, you know, somewhat a general rule, the majority of transmission happens in close indoor situations where you're spending a good bit of time together. That is why it is absolutely essential to be wearing a mask, especially inside. It doesn't mean that there's no risk if you're outside and there's, you know, only a brief encounter, but it's reduced. So if you're running and you pass somebody for a second, I'm not super worried about that situation. Now, if they cough and sneeze and you just slam right into it, Sam, that's a different scenario. You go home, wash your face, wash your hands. But the, you know, the experts that I'm talking to are not super worried about that situation.
All right, follow-up question for you on this topic. As a runner, I have heard mixed messaging about wearing a mask when you run. Some folks say, well, you're outside, you're moving fast, just dodge and weave and stay away from people.
Yeah.
Others are like, you have to have it on all the time. When I've done both, but when I've tried to run with a mask on my entire 5 miles, I end up with a wet mask and it's like I'm waterboarding myself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, wearing a mask if you can is a good situation. And if you're in a really, really busy city and you can't get away from people, if you're like constantly dodging people, I actually do think it's probably a good idea. But if you're in an area where it's a little bit more open, I would say it's probably okay not to wear a mask when you're running. Again, anytime you have the choice between them, a mask is going to be a safer bet. But if you can get up really early before somebody's out there or go somewhere else and it's, you know, like either I'm not going to run or I'm going to run without a mask, then I think that's a decision you have to make.
So you're saying we should be doing 3 a.m. runs in cemeteries?
I'm saying, Sam, stop phoning it in. Get up at 3 a.m. and get this done.
Get it done. Get it done. Yes. Next question from a listener.
All right, let's do it.
About animals. Can I say hi to other people's dogs? Oh, yeah.
Sam.
Good question.
Is this question from a listener or is this question
this
from
question is from my heart.
Shanders
this question
hotmail.com.
Is from my heart because I need to talk to the doggies and make sure they're okay.
Okay, so I looked this up because I wasn't sure. And the CDC has weirdly complicated guidance on this. So
really?
Some pets, like dogs or cats, have caught COVID from humans. But the CDC also says the risk of dogs then giving COVID to people is considered low. Like there's no evidence that you can get it from the fur or the hair of other pets. But
if you're one of those owners that kisses your dog on the mouth.
Well, I was just about to say. So, but this, because the CDC still says you should not interact with dogs outside their household. So I'm like, man, I guess the CDC is worried about people getting pet saliva in their mouths, but you shouldn't be macking on somebody else's dog anyway, Sam. You know what I mean? Don't.
If you see a dog and the dog is really, really, really cute.
Oh, my God. You're part of the problem, Sam.
I cannot miss the kiss. I cannot miss the kiss.
You are going to have to definitely miss the kiss for a while, Sam. But I will say, honestly, you know, briefly, a dog has come up to me in the dog park. Its owner is far away. I have pet it. I'll say it. I have pet it. But this is, you know, official guidance is leave those dogs alone, Sam.
Okay. Understood. Understood. All right. Okay. This is one that gives me so much. I think about this question every day and I get mad about it because no one can tell me what the right deal is. Okay. What is the deal with wiping down groceries? And should anyone actually be doing this?
Okay. So this is a great question. And again, Sam, it's not, you know, like, it's a level of risk that you're trying to decide here. So I like this question because it really gets to the question about picking up the virus from surfaces, right? So I would say, generally speaking, the contaminated surfaces that I'm worried about most are those like at surfaces at hospitals or in small enclosed spaces without much airflow that a person has been in for a really long time, or surfaces that come in contact with your face or mouth a lot, like a cell phone. Those are surfaces that I'm going to wipe down most of the time. I'm not as worried about a package of Oreos, double stuffed specifically, to be clear, from the groceries. Like, I'm not that worried about it. So what I do is I wear a mask. I hand sanitize when I'm shopping. Certainly after interacting with the cashier, I get home, I unload the groceries, I wash my hands. But, you know, again, this is a decision that I'm making as a healthy human. So if you're particularly worried or you have a condition that makes you susceptible, there's no harm in being extra safe.
Okay. Well, this is also, like, this gets to a larger question, which I still ask a lot, is, like, how long can this thing really just live on a surface? And I'm still not sure we know, and I think it varies by surface and by condition.
It does. Okay. It does. And another thing to think about is just because some virus is on a surface doesn't mean it's still infectious. You know, it doesn't mean there's enough of it to get you sick necessarily. It's all kind of a numbers game. So, you know, surfaces are not something to be totally dismissed. I'm not saying that. But generally speaking, with groceries, that kind of stuff, you can wipe them down if you want to. But that's not the highest risk scenario I'm worried about.
Gotcha, gotcha. You should just avoid making out with the cashier's dog at the grocery store.
I mean, Sam, if you can, it sounds like it's going to be a struggle for you.
I don't want people writing in thinking weird things about me and dogs. I am totally above board, okay? Okay? All right, next question. How often should I disinfect my phone?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know this is a nasty surface, Sam.
Phones are so nasty.
They're
phones
so are like, nasty.
Phones are like the toilet seats of public life.
I mean, Sam, do you bring your phone into the bathroom with you? Be honest.
You know, if I'm going to be there a while.
This is what I'm saying. So you've got to be wiping that surface. Like, it's next to your face. It's next to your mouth. We think with coronavirus, if you're getting it for a surface, it's from touching that surface and then touching your hands or mouth. And there's nothing that I put closer to my face than my phone. Mm-hmm. So I disinfect my phone a lot. I try to do it when I wash my hands because I wash my hands and I'm going to touch this dirty phone again. I don't think so. Yeah. So I have put hand sanitizer directly on my phone in
Same.
A pinch, which
oh,
is,
yeah.
It's not the best way. Like, a little bleach wipe will do you good, but it's definitely something you want to be doing.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Does alcohol lower my ability to fight COVID?
Sam, it
don't
does.
Give me don't.
It
don't,
does.
Don't depress me with this answer.
I will say you will be devastated to know that alcohol does suppress the immune response as a general rule, especially if you're drinking a lot. And the NIH even put out this statement that says if you're drinking when you're exposed to coronavirus, it hampers your immediate ability to stave off infection. I know. And the other thing to think about here, Sam, though, is when you're drunk, you're also making decisions that you might not make when you're sober, Sam. I mean, this accounts for my entire junior year of college. You know what I mean? Like, there are decisions that I wish I could undo. So,
you know?
It's not just about your immune system. It's also about how close are you going to get to somebody? How loud are you going to talk? So, unfortunately, Sam, for you, I can hear it in your voice. You're sad. But there are a lot of good reasons not to be drinking in a large group of people right now, at least excessively.
Okay. All right, next question. If I get a piece of hair stuck in my mouth while wearing my mask, it feels like an existential dilemma. What should I do? All right, sorry, just sidebar real quick. I'm the guy in the restaurant where if I see a piece of hair in my food, I'm like, well, the hair got cooked. We're good.
Yeah.
And I just eat it. I'm glad you have, honestly,
for this answer, I'm glad you have a pro-eating hair mentality, because I will say, as a person who has worked in a lab with infectious pathogens, when I'm trying not to touch my face and like one little tiny stray hair gets out of my hair tie, I will say you learn to eat that hair, Sam. It's part of the journey. But I do think, you know, it depends on where you are. If you have a safe space to take your mask off, deal with the hair, wash, hand sanitize, put that mask back on. I don't have time for all that. So you just eat that hair and you be strong.
Eat that hair. Also, let's be real here. Most hair is cleaner than your cell phone.
Because
a lot of
true,
folks
Sam.
Out here wash their hair more than their phones.
Ew, that's true.
I speak truth. I know y'all don't want to hear it, but you need to. Okay. Next question. Can you contract COVID from a swimming pool?
Well, well, well. Finally, I have some good news, Sam Sanders.
Thank you. About time.
So, according to the CDC, there's no evidence that you could pick up COVID from pool water. Like, just from being in a pool with somebody who had COVID.
There's chlorine in it. I know.
Well, there's a lot of situations going on. One of them is that it's diluted, right? So it's like diluted in a bunch of other stuff, let's be honest. But But what I would say is that, like, I would never go to an indoor pool right now.
Okay.
You know, I would be really careful about social distancing outside the pool, around the pool. Like, as soon as I get back to my little chair, I'm putting my mask on for sure around all these people that I don't know. And I wouldn't be getting closer to 6 feet. So you still have to keep yourself kind of away from people while you're in the pool. Like, I wouldn't go into a super crowded pool, but the water itself should not get you sick.
Okay. Good to know.
Mm.
Last question, actually. Oh, a heart-wrenching question. How do I smile at people while wearing a mask?
Honestly, Sam. Yeah. Wow. The emotional range of these questions are killing me.
It's a lot.
It's a good question, Sam. I guess with your eyes, I don't know. I've also found scientifically that waving works.
Okay.
But, you know, smile with your eyes, scream inside your heart, #2020. This is
wow.
What you're talking
about. Wow. Can we make t-shirts that say that? Smile with your eyes, scream inside your heart. I love it.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Thank you for answering my and other listeners' COVID questions. And thanks to those listeners for sending the questions in.
Yeah,
Jesse, Hannah, Catherine, Sarah, Marisol, Natalie, Alyssa, and Annie. I will add one last follow-up question based on seeing all these questions come in. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have so much anxiety around coronavirus and this pandemic. Mm-hmm. It's approaching like OCD.
Yeah.
How can people throughout their day take care of their anxiety around this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, Sam, this is a big question, right? Like, there's something to be said about us knowing that we're going to be in this for a while, right? And that's pretty scary. But I think one thing that gives me a little bit of solace and a little bit of hope is that we're not helpless in this situation. Mm. You know what I mean? There are things we can do to minimize our risks. There are things we can do to take care of our essential workers who are keeping this country afloat right now. And that is trying to take care of each other, trying to take care of your mental health, you know, trying to exercise outside when you can. And know that we do have some agency here. We can make changes that can help us get to the other side of this, however long that will be. And so sometimes that's something that I hang on to.
Yeah. Pet your dog. Don't kiss your dog.
Don't.
And go outside.
I mean, certainly don't be kissing other people's dogs, Sam. We need to have a talk on the way home in the car
about
this.
But they're so cute.
Oh, my God, Sam. Get your mouth off these dogs. Thanks to Sam Sanders for having me on It's Been a Minute, which is a great show if you want a weekly digest of the news that will help you process events without feeling overwhelmed by them. We've got a link to their podcast feed on Apple and Spotify in our episode notes. I'm Maddie Sofia, back next week with more Shortwave from NPR.
And finally today, we bring you a story about a Texas woman who was bored but short on resources, so she got creative.
My name is Nezi Shabazz, and I'm a resident of Keller, Texas. And I'm a senior. I'm 72 years old, and with shelter in place, I get bored and just start creating masks and different things like that. I do make some of my clothes, and so I had some scrap fabric left over from some of them. I had a long sleeve blouse
made it three-quarter length sleeves and took the rest of it and made a mask. Because the time I paid my rent, I got $9 left over. So that's not very much to do anything with. And so you just take what you have and you just repurpose it. And that's basically what I did. I had a big white flower, silk flower. So I took the leaves and kind of put it where the earlobes are. And I hand sewed it all the way around to where it looks like a big mum or something. It's quite massive. But it keeps coronavirus out, okay? And every time I do go out, say for instance to Kroger's or Tom Thumb's or the dollar store, and I love Lowe's, I'll have a mask on and people will stop me. Four or five people will stop me and say, oh my God, where'd you get that mask? So it gets attention. I mean, I didn't do it for attention. I just figured out, well, hey, if I have to wear a mask, it might as well match what I have on. That was my purpose. I have something called osteofibrosis, to where my knees do not bend. But the thing is, I would not let this disability steal my joy, because I'm still alive and there's millions of people in the world that wish they can walk as good as I can. I can walk. A little funny, but I do walk. So I don't look at what doesn't work. I look at what does work. And I can stand there and I can make something small, like mask and things like that. Just a little sewing. I don't do near as much as I used to. And I'm a sixth generation seamstress. I could think about all the things that hurt me. I could think about the person that bludgeoned me with a hammer and left me for dead. I could think about, I suffered police brutality too in the early 60s. You know, I had a grandmother that was murdered. But the thing is, I don't dwell on that. You got to love and forgive everybody no matter what they did and keep going on, because love is the most powerful thing that we have. And that's what the whole world needs right now, each and every one of us, is to love unconditionally. Well, I tell you, it was a plum pleasing pleasure just to talk to you. I'm Nezzy Shabazz, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, August 4th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. We'll bring you USA Today with national news coming up next, followed at 3 o'clock with local news. And here are some of the articles we'll be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Midland ISD to start with at-home instruction. Midland College is gradually opening its doors. National Weather Service says 100-degree heat returns to forecast. From the Odessa American, commissioners undertake budget. Five dead since Friday. And OC board to consider budget. Those are a few of the articles we'll be reading from the local newspapers at 3 o'clock. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 95 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
This is Sister Elaine Bielman reporting for USA Today, August 4th, 2020. Lunatic hiding in plain sight. The angel came to Roy Den Hollander on a warm evening in Moscow in July 1999. He was in a bar, according to